Israeli regime and its economy as they call on the U.S. to help address those losses. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
The Islamic Movement and Jordanian activists organize a pro-Palestinian march under the banner Save Resilient Jabalia in Amman. They express the strong support for Palestinians in northern Gaza, particularly in Jabalia. Participants condemned the severe humanitarian conditions there, citing continuous attacks, starvation tactics, and a total blockade on food and medical supplies.
Mass atrocities continue in Jabalia for the 24th consecutive day. The occupying forces appear intent on forced displacement, which, if unchallenged, could also include Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. We must firmly reject all forms of forced displacement.
We gather here today to support Gaza, acknowledging that no action we take, whether now, in the future, or even in the past, can be compared to the sacrifices made by the Palestinians there. We hope for a swift end to the war. May God have mercy on all the martyrs.
Participants criticize the international community's inaction in the face of Israeli crimes, expressing solidarity with displaced people in Jabalia refugee camp, who are now under siege. They also reaffirm their commitment to supporting the resistance against the Israeli occupation.
Today, we stand together to boost the spirit of our brothers in Gaza, who are making sacrifices for a noble cause. I want to emphasize that even if the leaders of the resistance are martyred, many will rise to take their place.
We are here to support our brothers in Jabalia, Gaza, and Palestine as they resist the aggressors. We ask God to grant them strength and success in their struggle.
Israel continues to displace Palestinians amid its ongoing military campaign in northern Gaza, applying deadly measures against approximately 400,000 individuals in the region, while enforcing a strict blockade that prevents the entry of food and medical supplies.
The Islamic Movement in Jordan has called for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip and demanded Amman sever its ties with the Tel Aviv regime. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
More than a year into Israel's genocidal war in Gaza has led to the death and injury of hundreds of thousands of people in the besieged territory. The rest left have been displaced and are fighting for very daily existence with the bare minimum in their hands. Trapped in tents and uninhabitable shelters, winter will harm thousands of displaced families struggling for any means of life amid the unfathomable carnage and the incessant Israeli horror inflicted upon them. And as starvation hits back, their lives will only become more hellish.
Our tents are uninhabitable. The summer heat has caused the tent's nylon components to tear. We've appealed to the organizations to assist with providing rainflies to keep the water from coming inside the tent, but we've yet to hear back. A lot of problems plague us here in the Shurab displacement camp. We've no food, blankets, rainflies, or covers. Our kids don't get medicine or even clothes. We've fled Al Shujaya neighborhood without anything.
Since our tent is merely made of ripped pieces, we are without covers, blankets, and rain flies. Here we have nothing. There is no food, medication, or clothes. At night, our little brother shivers from the cold. We only have one blanket. We don't have anything to cover ourselves with. We can't even fit in our tiny tent.
Winter clothes have been banned from entering the strip, adding to people suffering in the face of extreme adversity. And for people who remain without shelter on the streets, the trauma they're facing will be unmatched.
The displaced people in Gaza have experienced terrible misery in every aspect of their lives as a result of Israel's genocidal war on the strip. They will now face additional traumas when winter approaches, depriving them of every means of survival and leaving them shivering with fear and cold. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
Kashmir, Balega! As in previous years, people from Pakistan and Kashmir took to the streets on October 27 to mark Black Day. Pakistan regards this day as the anniversary of India's defiance of British Partition Plan in 1947, which led to India's control over the Jammu and Kashmir regions. The day was marked with rallies, protests, and seminars to express solidarity with the Kashmiri people and their continued struggle for self-determination under Indian control.
We will continue to raise voice for the oppressed people of Kashmir who are facing atrocities by Indian forces in Jammu and Kashmir regions. We want justice from the international community for their right of self-determination.
We condemn Indian illegal occupation of Jammu and Kashmir region. Kashmiris have been struggling for their right to self-determination for the past 77 years. Thousands of Kashmiris, men, women, and children have been brutally killed by Indian occupied forces in recent years, and the international community is just a silent observer.
Kashmir, a predominantly Muslim Himalayan region, remains a point of division between India and Pakistan, both holding parts of it but claiming the region in full. The Kashmir conflict has led to several wars between the nuclear-armed neighbors since their separation in 1947. The observance of Kashmir Solidarity Day allows not only the people of Pakistan, but also its government to voice their support for the Kashmir liberation movement.
Pakistan will continue to extend political, diplomatic, and moral support to our Kashmiri brothers and sisters for the just and peaceful settlement of the Jammu and Kashmir dispute in accordance with the UN Security Council resolutions.
Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari and the Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif urged the international community to push India to end human rights abuses in Jammu and Kashmir regions and to implement UN Security Council resolutions.
In the face of global diplomatic pressure, Pakistan's stance remains unwavering as it advocates for a resolution that aligns with the Kashmiri people's aspirations and their right to self-determination. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
The multinational financial institution Barclays was forced to close its doors in Belfast on Saturday due to a Palestinian rights protest. The bank has supported arms suppliers to Israel to the tune of more than £8 billion since 2021 alone.
We want them to understand that it's wrong. We want them to understand that they don't have to profit off war and death and destruction. We don't have to profit off dead people. We don't have to profit of bombs being dropped on kids, on hospitals and schools.
Activists are convinced that Washington is responsible for the Middle East crisis.
Obviously, the United States are driving it. Look at the size of Israel. It's a tiny country. It isn't even a country. It's just on somebody else's land. It's tiny, absolutely tiny. And look at the control they have. Look at the power they have. Look at the weapons they have.
Barclays, you can divest from. You have like McDonald's here. They're actually giving free meals and things to the IDF, and it's just appalling. And you know, I personally don't want my money to be used in that sort of way.
Despite public outcry across the globe, the Israeli regime's indiscriminate killing of innocent civilians in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, and Lebanon shows no sign of abating.
It's typical Western foreign policy, really, trying to control the world through proxies, and I think Israel is a proxy that's gone rogue and it's out of control.
They'll say, you have to stop doing this, now here are the bombs to do it with.
So you think the United States is talking out of both sides of its mouth?
Yes, absolutely, and it has been for generations.
The campaign to encourage customers to close their Barclays accounts was launched in July 2022, and since then almost 4,000 people have done so. That effort is ongoing. It is easy to switch banks in the UK, and these campaigners want as many people as possible to close their Barclays accounts on the same day to ensure the greatest possible impact. And that day is Thursday, November the 21st. Jerome Hughes, Belfast.
The Husseiniya of Imam Khomeini is filled with people who are here to meet Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The families are holding up pictures of their martyred loved ones. These are families that have lost a loved one for Iran's security.
This is one of the routine meetings that the leader holds with members of the public, and this time it is with families of martyrs who gave their lives to protect Iran. For those in attendance, a rare honor. Their presence, a strong act of support. Their chants, a powerful pledge of allegiance.
This is the first time I have the privilege of meeting the leader, and I am filled with excitement.
I have had the distinct honor of meeting the leader on 4 or 5 separate occasions.
With all my heart, I am immensely proud of my martyred husband for his sacrifice.
We are immensely grateful to all our youth from diverse backgrounds and varying perspectives for their unwavering support of the leader. Their love and honor for the martyrs are a testament to their devotion.
If the leader calls for war, I am ready to make the ultimate sacrifice, just as my husband did.
If the leader calls for war, I will be the first to answer the call.
Our loyalty to the leader and the Islamic Republic is unwavering. We believe this will help ensure that Iran remains strong and resilient.
Iran has lost numerous service members and civilians in terrorist attacks and conflicts against invading forces. Today, Iran owes its peace, security, and territorial integrity to the sacrifices made by these families' loved ones, making this meeting particularly meaningful.
But the timing of this meeting makes it even more significant, amplifying every word of the leader, with a huge crowd taking every opportunity to offer their support.
Just 2 days after the Israeli regime's military aggression, described by Ayatollah Khamenei as an evil act that must neither be magnified nor downplayed, many Iranians are calling for retaliation. Chants of allegiance resonate through the crowd as the leader draws attention to Israel's horrific war crimes committed in complete disregard for the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions. Ayatollah Khamenei expressed disappointment over the international community's inaction against the Israeli regime and called for a diplomatic, economic, and even military coalition to oppose it. Most importantly, he emphasized that the Israeli regime must be made to recognize the strength, determination, and resourcefulness of the Iranian nation. Now, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, it is up to the responsible officials to take appropriate action. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
IranRadio.ir. What you just heard was an Iradi English radio program.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Now in a week, it will be 13 months that the Israeli regime has been systematically turning the entire Gaza Strip's 360 square kilometers of land into a heap of rubble, an onslaught that has not spared women, including mothers, children, including infants, doctors, paramedics, journalists, homes, hospitals, shelters, or places of worship. And now after expanding its bloodshed into Lebanon, we see it is not just Palestinians that the Zionists are at odds with. In short, if you are in West Asia and not Jewish, the Israeli war machine is coming for you. And the regime's brutality and its Western-issued license to kill with impunity is the focus of Spotlight. Joining us now for the program is Zadwan Rizk, a political analyst, joining us from Beirut. And Kim Shadif, activist and lawyer, joining us from London. Hello to the both of you and welcome to the program. I guess, Ms. Shadif, we'll start with you. We'll do the gentlemanly thing and start in London. Your initial thoughts on the UN Special Rapporteur, Kim, on occupied Palestinian territories. She had a lot to say this week. Francesca Albanese, one of the things she said about 4 days ago, she said the Israeli regime's campaign of genocide in Gaza is not just restricted to Palestinians in Gaza. By all accounts, she strongly believes it will spread ultimately to the occupied West Bank, because she said it's all part of a broader systematic plan to kill off or push every single Palestinian, every last Palestinian, off of their land. Your initial thoughts.
Yes, good evening to you both. And I totally agree with her. It's just harrowing to listen to her findings and detailed analysis of the law as it stands, international law that is. And it's just shocking to see how much campaign of harassment and maltreatment she has been facing for standing up and telling the truth and analyzing the law as it is. She's an expert on the matter, and she's absolutely right. She used the term, this is a project of colonial erasure, meaning basically, as you quite rightly pointed out, it's spreading out. And there are rumors among Arab political analysts that the next plan, the next step is after Beirut, after Lebanon, is Jordan itself. And the Zionist regime has never made it a secret that it has always had an ambitious plan to expand throughout the Arabian Peninsula, literally, and going all the way to Basra, in the words of one of their own ministers on a TV interview. And the methods they are using in terms of, if you analyze the actual activities carried out by the IOF, you will see that they're always targeting women and children. They're always targeting civilian infrastructures, hospitals, refugee camps, homes, schools, even UN-affiliated schools and UN agencies themselves aren't free from the attack of the IOF. Or also journalists and international humanitarian aid workers. The purpose behind all of these activities is clearly to kill and kill and kill Palestinians without any mercy or hesitation or second thought to the rules of law and to the international system. And unfortunately, they wouldn't have been able to carry on doing what they are doing. And in front of our own eyes, the whole world is watching hideous genocide unfolding on a daily basis. And if it hadn't been for the staunch Western support that it is receiving, the Zionist regime wouldn't have been able to carry out. So in legal analysis, you need to ask the question, but for, you have to apply the but for test in order to establish causal link and to see who's actually carrying out this genocide. It's not just the IOF, it's not just the Zionist regime. There are Western backers who are enabling this genocide when they know full well there is a duty under the Genocide Convention to prevent genocide and to punish those who are committing it. And we don't need to name the names, but everybody knows who these countries are. It is actually a great shame and disgrace on leading international countries who have always claimed to be pro-democracy, pro-human rights, pro-playing by the rules, but they are flouncing the rules and enabling a third party to do so without any hesitation, without any shame, without any second thinking, without any respect for the rule of law, which is a very, very unfortunate situation in the international platform. But I think in the long run, it's going to have a very dire consequences for those carrying out this genocide and those who are enabling it, US and UK in particular, I have in mind. And I'm really disappointed to see that these two countries who have always been telling us that they are the beacons of democracy, the beacons of human rights, the beacons of civil liberties and so on, civilization, etc. They are now showing themselves to be nothing less than straightforward barbarians dressed up in suits. And that is really a very, very frightening and disgraceful scenario to be finding ourselves in as citizens of the West ourselves. Because we don't know what to say yet. We are watching genocide unfolding in front of our own eyes, carried out in the most hideous and dreadful ways, killing little children, killing babies, killing women and sick people in hospitals, killing that is just too much to bear. I think the whole of humanity in the world today is suffering huge trauma as a direct result of this. And again, I go back to the point of the but for test.
Okay, Sharif, let me please. I don't want to cut you off, but let me welcome Mr. Radwan Rizk. I don't mean to cut you off, but we have time limits. Mr. Rizk, welcome to the conversation, sir. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
And I'm glad Kim mentioned that she is shocked, because these are exactly. This is exactly what Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestinian Territories, she said. She said that the whole world, not just herself, is shocked that the regime is getting away with this level of barbarity and genocide and for so long. And exactly to Kim's point, again, she mentioned the word enabler. She said Washington, and then she said that today is the ultimate enabler, sitting back and allowing Israel and even helping Israel carry out this genocide. And she mentioned what I wanted to... I mentioned from her words today, though, Mr. Rizk, she called Israel a serial violator, of international law, and said that it deserves to be suspended from the United Nations. Now, you know, back in late 1947, the UN adopted a resolution 181 that led to the creation of Israel. And time and again, the regime when there's anti-Israel resolutions passed by the UN, it laughs at the UN, the very a body that helped create its existence. It laughs at it. It questions its jurisdictions. It questions its authority. Has zero respect for the UN. And your initial thoughts, and then I'll show you where I'm taking this argument. Go ahead.
Well, our experience, if we go back to the history, as you have said, since 1947 with the UN resolution to the crisis in Palestine, just name me one time that Israel respected the international law, and we are talking about the international law. Has at any time, at any decision was taken by the UN was respected by the Israelis. And I don't believe that and I don't agree on one point that the Israelis are breaking the law, the international law. No, I think that the international law does not apply to the Israelis, government, and also that's what so-called the free world, respected freedom for for the people in anywhere. This is only applies to their own societies. But when it comes to the what so-called the third world, as they call us, that's the law does not apply. It's not forced, and it's not respected. A massacre is taking place now in Gaza and Lebanon also. Now we are seeing massacres done in Lebanon also. We are seeing the same scenes, the same scenarios applying from the Israeli monsters against the Lebanese people. Now we have more than 1,500,000 people displaced. And every time and every day we see they sent threatenings to the civilians to evacuate their villages, their homes, and we don't know how far this can go, because this is a total genocide against the Lebanese people also, as they have done and continues in Gaza. I think that Netanyahu will not stop at any time, because he is implementing the plans of the what's so called the free world. I'm talking about the Americans and especially the British. I agree with Mrs. Sharif, and also with the full support of other European countries, and we must not forget some of the Arab countries also who have joined the plot against our. Just sinking their hands in our blood, in our children being killed, newborn children. Now we have more than 500 Lebanese children also killed under 10 years age. And also most of them are, and the others are women. And the majority of the people killed in Lebanon are civilians. We can say 99% are civilians. They were killed in their homes, and they were not at any time at the front lines. We are talking about far north. We are talking about the Aito massacre, 22 people, which is the far north. I'm talking about 220 kilometers away from the borders. And also we're talking about Hermel area, which is about 220 kilometers away from the borders. And these villages were demolished most of the time. And many of the civilians were killed in their houses for no reason. Now Netanyahu is just showing us the real face of the Americans and the British also,
right.
And this is their policy to push us or to. I'm talking about a plan displacing or evacuating the Lebanese society, and the Lebanese soils from any kind of resistance against this brutal enemy.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Kim, Mr. Risk said something interesting. He mentioned it's been very short. I mean, the conflict between Hezbollah and the Israeli regime has been ongoing for over a year now, but it kicked up in September drastically. You very well know over the last couple months. To date, over 500 children have been, in only 2,800 death toll, over 500 of those have been children. The Lebanese authorities said that's one Lebanese child has been killed every day since this thing ramped up in late September. So my question to you, 16,000 children in Gaza, now well over 500, and the regime in Tel Aviv has shown zero restraint in going after areas where they're densely populated with women and children in Gaza and now in Lebanon, yet it has shown zero interest in accepting or even really going into advanced talks for a ceasefire to put an end to this atrocious violence. Why?
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, you go back to the report of Francesca Albanese. I highly recommend that everyone who's interested in this file looks at her report in detail. She actually refers to incidents where she had spoken or prior to October 7th last year to hearing from a number of Israeli ministers saying that when they were told, "Why are you killing children and pregnant women?" And he said, "They are future terrorists." And so the pregnant woman is a future terrorist, and the child is also a future terrorist. So these people are convicted of a crime that may or may not happen in the future. This is a Minority Report scenario being played out in real life in relation to the Palestinians and the Lebanese. Of course they have no respect for the lives of other children, because the only children that matter to the Zionist entity is their own children, no other life, their own lives, no other life matters to them. That's because they are inherently, ideologically racist, extremist, supremacist. I was listening to a podcast by a very well-respected and well-learned scholar, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro, pointing out that this Zionist entity, had actually stolen the Jewish entity, the Jewish identity, and is a pretender, an imposter, is pretending to be representing Judaism when it has nothing to do with Judaism, as most of them are, in fact, even the ones who founded them, were atheists, and they don't have anything to do in terms of practicing Judaism on a daily basis. And therefore, I am not surprised that they are targeting, and specifically targeting children, because they want to not only kill the actually existing people today, adult humans, but they also want to kill potential future adult humans as represented by that in the children and pregnant women. Almost always they are targeting civilian infrastructure, which contains usually large population of women and children. And if you go back to see what's happening to them in the borders of the southern borders of Lebanon, Hezbollah have been scoring really amazing successes there. They are unable to confront men, fighting men man to man. They can't do that. They're cowards. They always use these weapons of mass destruction, some of which are prohibited for use in international law. But they are, you know, we say that international law doesn't apply to them. That does apply to them. Then why on earth are they a member of the UN? Why have they not been kicked out? Why have they not been sanctioned like many other countries who are alleged to have breached certain rules are automatically sanctioned and maltreated by the rest of the world? Why is this rogue regime, why this criminal, terrorist, rogue regime that has zero respect for the law of the UN, and the UN officials themselves, UN agencies themselves, are subject to the same level of harassment and torture and killing as is happening to the Palestinian people. UNRWA, for example, was the only source of food supply that has been banned on the furious allegation that they are a terrorist entity. How can the UN be a terrorist entity? If the UN is a terrorist entity, then clearly this rogue entity that has no leg to stand, as per the finding of the ICJ in relation to its status, then the UN really needs to go and revise its books and do something about this. 82 countries, 3 countries, 4 countries, some of whom are permanent members of the Security Council, insisting on enabling the continuation of this horrific genocide. Then the rest of the world act and do something. It's specifically, like my colleague on the show has just noted, a lot of Arab and Muslim countries are doing nothing. Some of them have vested interest in doing nothing and perhaps even aiding and abetting the Zionist regime's genocide campaign, because they are worried that their own thrones would be lost if they were to do anything. And this is a very amazing test for humanity today. We are at the crossroads. You either go in the right side or you go in the wrong side. And if you go in the wrong side, I am pretty confident the consequences will be very dire for those who have not even at least stood up and said, this is wrong, stop it now.
Thank you, Ms. Sharif. Compassionate, and everybody feels exactly your frustration. Mr. Riss, there's so many voices say, why doesn't the U.S. ramp up pressure on the Israeli regime to bring about peace, to get it to accept a ceasefire? But one can also argue peace has never been America's business. Through its inception, America has been at war, listen to this, 93% of the time, 222 years of the 239 years since 1776, the U.S. has only been at peace 20 years throughout that time. Let that sink in, and how that reflects on West Asia moving forward. Peace has never been the business of America, and no one should expect it to pressure the Israeli regime into making it its business.
Well, if we go back that far into the American history, we must not forget the cleansing of the Red Indians. And then the slavery in America has a very long history of treating people extremely savage just because of their skin colors. This is the history of America. America thinks as an empire that it can continue suppressing free people and occupying more countries, stealing more wealth of the countries, and that's why we are facing this kind of double scaling measures in the Middle East. They are after the oils in Gaza, the gas in Gaza, also in Lebanon, and they want to expand the size of the Israelis' land. They want to, as Trump said a couple of weeks ago, that Israel is too small as a country and we must expand this country. So on what expenses is he going to kick us out of our land and bring more settlers from all over the world to build more settlements? We must mention that some of the rabbis and some of the companies in Israel starting to offer lands in southern Lebanon for sale. It's planning to build up settlements in our land. And we are still alive. We are still here. We're still fighting. And we're still resisting. And we're still harassing this brutal coward army in the southern Lebanon, as you can see all over the news, because 5 brigades, 70 to 80,000 Israeli soldiers, supported by all the planes from the jet fighters from the Americans, from the British, and some news also from the Emirates, United Arab Emirates, joining the Israeli army, They cannot even cross, they haven't crossed the borders after 5 weeks of fighting. So we are resisting and we are going to continue resisting, no matter what the price, because this is, you know, it hits our existence. It's not only our to save our lands or to protect our country. It's our existence now in the scale. And the whole world, especially the Arab world, we are talking about the Arab world. I'm not blaming the Europeans because they are part of the plot, but I'm talking about the Islamic world and the Arab world, which is, you know, standing there watching us being killed by all those brutal armies, joined by all the forces, German, French, British, Americans, of course, and some of the Arab countries are a part of this demolishing machine, which is, you know, it can do nothing but doing more and more massacres against the Palestinians and against the Lebanese. And nobody knows if we are defeated, the turn will be to for Jordan and against Syria also, and the turn will be in after that Egypt. They don't want to understand that. They cannot understand that. They cannot accept that, because those regimes that we are talking about, especially in Jordan and Egypt, they are nothing but Muppets, and they are supporting the Israelis with every possible way they can.
Mr. Risk, thank you, Mr. Risk and Mrs. Sharif. Time has gotten the better of us, but thank you both for putting time in joining us on the program. Mr. Radwan Risk, political analyst, joining us there out of Beirut, and Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer, joining us from London. And this brings us to the end of this segment to your spotlight. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The European Union is fearful of a Donald Trump victory in the U.S. presidential election, which could mean a substantial cut to military aid to Ukraine, effectively leaving the country to fend for itself. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Euronews has covered this story and tells us more. As the US presidential election gets closer, Brussels fears a Trump victory could leave Ukraine to fend for itself. To say the European Union is anxiously awaiting the outcome of the United States presidential elections would be an understatement. The poll on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean has the potential to upend many, if not all, of the bloc's policies, from trade flows and industrial subsidies to digital oversight and antitrust probes. But no other field triggers the same immediate fears as the Russia-Ukraine war, where any disruption, even if small, could prove a game-changer on the battlefield. The profound unease stems from the words of Donald Trump, the Republican candidate, who has made no secret of his displeasure with America's aid to Ukraine. Earlier this year, as the U.S. Congress negotiated a foreign aid package that allocated $60 billion in military supplies for Ukraine, Donald Trump attempted to influence the procedure by pushing for the assistance to be structured as a loan rather than a grant. "We should never give money anymore without the hope of a payback or without strings attached," the United States of America should be stupid no longer, Trump wrote on Truth Social, the platform that he owns. Later, at a rally in June, the billionaire described Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky as maybe the greatest salesman of any politician that's ever lived. Every time he comes to our country, he walks away with $60 billion, Trump said, referring to the aid package. Donald Trump added, he gets home and he announces that he needs another $60 billion, and I say, it never ends. It never ends. The crowd cheered as Trump added, I will have that settled prior to taking the White House as president-elect. Then in July, Donald Trump met with one of his closest allies in Europe, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orbán, to discuss the conflict. He will not give a penny in the Ukraine-Russia war, Viktor Orbán said after a bilateral encounter. Therefore, the war will end because it is obvious that Ukraine cannot stand on its own feet. Viktor Orbán doubled down on his remarks in a defiant letter addressed to his fellow European Union leaders. In the letter, he warned that Donald Trump's likely re-election would shift the financial dynamics between the United States and the European Union regarding support for Ukraine. It is this shift that makes Brussels fret. From the early days of the Russia-Ukraine war, Brussels has been in close contact with Washington to coordinate their response and fortify the Western Front against Russia. In President Joe Biden, the European Union found a staunch vocal advocate of the transatlantic alliance who firmly agreed that Russia was in breach of international law and Ukraine had the right to defend itself. Although both sides had remained independent in their policy choices, their paths have converged along the same lines. On the one hand, support for Ukraine's army and economy, and on the other hand, sanctions pressure on Russia. The US, a world-class manufacturer of military gear, has primarily focused on providing Kiev with the advanced weapons that it needs to fight the Russian forces, supplying more than $64 billion in military assistance since the start of the war, according to government figures. The donations have included long-range attack MS missiles and the much-needed Patriot air defense system. The European Union and member states have also supplied military aid to Ukraine worth 43.5 billion euros, but suffered notable hiccups, such as a target to deliver 1 million artillery rounds by March of 2024 that was roundly missed, and a 6.6 billion euro envelope that is still blocked by Hungary. The European bloc has seen greater success in its injections of financial, economic and humanitarian support, with 57.8 billion euros already disbursed and more in the pipeline. In parallel to these efforts, the Atlantic partners have acted as co-leaders in several groundbreaking initiatives at the G7 level. Few people in Brussels believe that the European Union can step in and make up for Washington's sudden absence. With a stagnant economy, an inferior defense industry, and a rise in far-right parties in Europe, the European bloc lacks the means to shoulder the entire burden on its own. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. As Kamala Harris and Donald Trump enter the final days of their closely fought White House contest, Europe is jittery about the potential impact of the US presidential election on the war in Ukraine and the European continent's security. The Austrian Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg told Reuters news agency, just a half a sentence uttered in a farm in southern Idaho brings everybody from Porto to Helsinki to panic. The Austrian foreign minister urged Europeans to stay calm to avoid feeding a sense of insecurity. Finnish President Alexander Stubb told Reuters news agency, "All of us are waiting for the elections to be over due to their international ramifications." When it comes to Ukraine and European security, many European officials say they're worried about a win for the Republican former President Donald Trump on 5th of November, given turbulent transatlantic relations in his previous term, his past strong criticism of NATO, and his ambivalence towards Kiev's fight against Russia. They say any end to the Ukraine war that President Vladimir Putin sees as a victory could embolden the Russian president to attack a NATO country. A German spy chief warned this month that Russia could be in a position to do so by the end of the decade, at the latest. President Putin has denied that he has any intention of attacking any NATO country. In recent weeks, Reuters news agency spoke with more than 20 senior European officials about the impact on Ukraine of the United States vote. Many spoke anonymously to discuss a vital ally. One theme dominated their comments: uncertainty, fueled by what they cited as Donald Trump's unpredictability during his first term in office. Together with the Biden administration, European officials have implemented measures they say should soften the blow of any quick withdrawal of United States aid to Kiev, where Donald Trump to take office in January, including a $50 billion loan to Ukraine and a rejig of military aid coordination. Those would be only a temporary reprieve for Kiev. Kamala Harris, the Democratic candidate, and President Joe Biden's vice president, is widely expected to keep supporting Ukraine while seeking to avoid escalation if she wins the election. Kamala Harris has been strongly critical of President Putin and has said if she wins, she will work to ensure that Kiev prevails in the war. Donald Trump, however, has said that if he wins on 5th of November, he could end the war in a day before even taking office. He has not said how he would do so.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Israel carries out multiple airstrikes on Lebanese capital Beirut overnight, killing several people. The death toll from the Israeli war on Gaza tops 43,200 as more Palestinians fall victim to the regime's relentless attacks. And the Democratic People's Republic of Korea launches its most advanced solid-fuel intercontinental ballistic missiles, saying the test is a warning to rivals. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story: Israelis carried out fresh airstrikes on southern suburbs of Lebanon's capital, Beirut. At least 10 strikes hit Beirut overnight after the Israeli military issued evacuation orders for some neighborhoods. Two people were reportedly killed and four others injured as a result. Lebanese media say the strikes left massive destruction with dozens of buildings leveled to the ground. Elsewhere, at least 12 people lost their lives in an Israeli airstrike on the northern Beqa region. Israel has also bombed other Lebanese cities, including Tyre and Zefta in the south. The regime intensified its air aggression against Lebanon on September the 23rd and launched a ground offensive days later. Since then, more than 1,800 Lebanese have been killed. That raises the total death toll to 2,800 since Israel began attacks on Lebanon in October last year. The Hezbollah resistance movement says over 95 Israeli soldiers and officers have been killed and 900 others wounded since the regime started its ground invasion against Lebanon. The movement said during the past 45 days, it has destroyed a large number of Israel's military vehicles, including 42 Merkava tanks. Resistance fighters have also downed three Hermes 450 and two Hermes 900 drones. This as Hezbollah continued to hit more Israeli targets in fresh retaliatory operations across the occupied territories. It launched rocket attacks on several Israeli military sites, including the Ramim barracks and a warehouse east of Akka, while targeting the settlements of Carmel, Metula, and Krayot. Several gathering points of the regime's soldiers were also directly hit with Hezbollah's rockets. Mariam Saleh is joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, with all the latest details and updates regarding the continued Israeli aggression against the people of Lebanon and also the retaliatory operations and attacks being carried out by the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah. Mariam?
Yes, Bardu. Well, as you mentioned, we had at least 11 strikes, actually, on the southern suburbs of Beirut. And this came right after, just minutes after a warning that was issued by the Israeli spokesperson. This is not the first time, but it seems that their strikes on the southern suburbs of Beirut are going on and off. But it seems that there seems to be some sort of a pattern. Every time the Israeli drones fly very close to the drones, even to the areas where